Episode 33 of Welcome to Level 7, Much Ado About Nothing.
Welcome to Level 7, the podcast about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Welcome to Level 7, the unofficial podcast of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I am one of your two scholars here this evening, Daniel Butcher. And with me here is a fine gentleman and scholar in his own right.
I'm Ben Avery, and I'm here to talk to you about superheroes.
Absolutely, sir.
Yes.
Sir, are you wearing your smoking jacket?
I am, with the patches on the elbows, not shoulders, because that'd be really weird.
But do you have pipe in hand?
I do have a pipe in hand.
Are bubbles coming out of it?
Yes. Bubbles. They're all over the place. I'm getting my keyboard wet with soap water. But I must keep up appearances.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we're sophisticated.
We are sophisticated. We're here to talk about heroes, or a hero anyway.
Absolutely, sir.
And spies.
And
plenty
villains.
Of spies. Maybe not super spies with cool watches, but...
constables.
And villainy aplenty, yes.
We're I do to... like the word constable.
We used to have a police officer who would visit our class. He was Constable Box. That was his real name.
And he wasn't even an alien.
Nope. He was
with
not.
A name like that, he should be.
Constable Box. He would come and tell us about bike safety.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So, Ben, this is kind of a weird episode.
It is. It's one-off. It's a week off, and we could talk about the episode they just put on tonight, but instead, we're going to talk about Shakespeare.
So... intelligence report.
Gone. We're not doing that tonight. No intelligence
field report.
Tonight. Not doing that tonight because we didn't get any feedback when we told people we were talking about Much Ado About Nothing.
Now, as a way to keep people's interest when we record next week, because we are going to record next week with feedback.
Yes.
We have tons of feedback about Seeds and Magical Place, and we have the return of Sky's best friend, John Wilkerson.
That's true. So we are indeed going to be doing an episode next week that's going to be news and feedback. That's all it's going to be. There's some interesting stuff. But for this episode, we're talking about Much Ado About Nothing. And, you know, we asked last week, what'd you think about us splitting it out? Well, I guess this is almost like a test case. But this is not going to be the norm. This is just the way it worked out. We got 2 weeks off from the show, and so we're taking this time to do an episode we planned again that we've been planning for a long time, and then do our feedback and news episode next week.
All right, shall we get into this mission report?
Yeah. Do we even need to play a sound effect when there is
it is required.
Yes. Okay. I'm gonna play the sound effect right now then for our mission report, and then we will jump into it. You ready?
Let's do it.
Mission report.
So, Daniel, it's time to make much ado about something.
Something? Nothing?
Well, we're making much ado about something. A movie, anyway. The movie, it's called Much Ado About Nothing. And
well,
we can talk a little about that later, maybe, what the title means. But
let's be honest. This is a very, very, very different movie for us. I think this is probably the first movie that we could classify as being a romantic comedy.
Yes.
It is the first movie that we...
possibly not the last, depending on how things work out with different casting things over the summer.
Knowing us, it probably won't be the last.
Yeah.
It is the first movie we've ever discussed, who the source material came from, Mr. William Shakespeare, who apparently is of some note.
It's the first movie slash television visual thingy that we talked about that did not come from a comic book originally.
Originally. Very, very important.
It's been made into a comic book since then, I'm sure. But
and I think this may be the first thing that we could officially say as part of the Whedonverse. Is this considered part of the Whedonverse?
You know, I'm going to say yes with a question mark at the end. I look at this and think it is. I don't know if people who actually would call themselves, you know, Whedonites, I think. Something like that. But I don't know if this is considered by them to be part of the Whedonverse, but I am assuming it would be. I can't imagine why it wouldn't be.
I would say just based on the cast.
Yeah. So now I look at the cast, Daniel, of Much Ado About Nothing, and I see so many familiar faces, but you know what they're familiar from? Firefly, Dollhouse, and Avengers.
See, and that's where I feel like I've been at a disadvantage in this movie. Because Amy Acker and, okay, and excuse me, I'm going to mispronounce this name, and someone's going to get mad at me. Alexis?
Yeah, Alexis.
Alexis Denisoff?
Don't know about the last name, but I know his first name is Alexis.
The two of them, I'll be honest, I've never really seen them in anything.
Yeah.
So for me, the familiar faces are Clark Gregg, of course, and then Sean Mayer.
Yes. Again, Firefly.
From Firefly.
Right.
Absolutely. And a sneak peek of Ashley Johnson, who was also familiar to me.
That would be
Chrissy from Growing Pains.
What?
Yeah. Chrissy Seaver. Little Chrissy Seaver.
You're kidding me.
No.
I had no idea.
Well, it's a very important... We're going to talk about her later in this episode. Because you think we're not going to talk about comic books.
I don't think we're not going to talk about comic books, but I can't say I'm going in thinking we're going to talk a lot about comic books. Because we'll definitely be talking about Clark Gregg.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and other things. So let's do some quick background.
Yeah.
So this is Much Ado About Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It is originally a comedic play written by William Shakespeare in 1598 and 1599. So again,
it's an oldie where I come from.
Well, and I'm glad you didn't say goody. I will admit, because all of William Shakespeare's work is public domain, about 5 days ago, I did download and get myself a copy of Much Ado About Nothing,
mm-hmm.
and I read exactly 4 pages because there was just so much going on.
Yeah, that comes up that causes me to come up with a question for you, Daniel, and that is, do you like Shakespeare? Are you into the Bard, man?
Am I into the Bard?
Are you into the Bard?
I think I like it when I'm done, but it's hard for me to get into. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the language is so different that it takes a while for me to get the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Even here in Much Ado About Nothing, it took me a while to kind of get the pacing of what was going on. And so, like, for some of the Dogberry scenes, for example, I knew they were funny, but it wasn't – and there was things I was laughing at, but I wasn't getting all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's true of the actors, too.
Absolutely.
You know, that's something – as a modern actor, you have to actually study and, like, look up, what in the world am I saying? You know, because high school Shakespeare – you've got people saying the words, but not necessarily even understanding the words. But if you're going to be doing a professional thing like what we're looking at here, you have to understand it to get the emotion and convey the emotion. But, you know, I like Shakespeare. I don't know. I've seen a number of Shakespeare movies, and I enjoy them. They're okay. You know, they're not the greatest in the world sometimes, but sometimes they're really fantastic. And so you have things like Ian Holm playing King Lear in a weird pseudo-future. You have Hamlet. You have Kenneth Branagh playing Hamlet, and it's, you know, a period piece. And you have, let's see, I'm trying to remember. There's one very recently. I think it was Hamlet again.
It's always Hamlet. Yeah. It's always Hamlet.
Hamlet gets done a lot, but so does Romeo and Juliet. You know, you have the Leonardo DiCaprio Romeo and Juliet thing.
Are you talking about Romeo and Juliet?
There's Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. I enjoy Shakespeare. Now, King Lear is my favorite Shakespeare play. I'll say this right now. I've never read Much Ado About Nothing, and I've only seen the Kenneth Branagh movie once.
Well, I've never seen the Branagh movie. Wait a minute.
I think
I have. And I enjoyed it, now that I think about it. I will say that, I mean, I don't go out seeking William Shakespeare movies. I do, however. I mean, I have seen a live performance of Richard III at the Globe,
mm-hmm.
and that really was a fantastic experience. But even there, it took a few minutes to get into the feel and the vibe, even though that cast was fantastic and having a fantastic time and playing with the groundlings. Again, it still took a while to figure out, okay, this is the villain, this is a comedy piece right here, so that we can relax a little bit.
Yeah. Watching Shakespeare is the way that Shakespeare is meant to be experienced. It's not meant to be read. It's not meant to be read in class by kids who don't know what they're saying. It's meant to be seen. And when you can see it happening, it allows you to understand a lot more of what's going on. And so here you have then Joss Whedon showing you his version of Shakespeare. His version of Much Ado About Nothing.
Let's talk about William Shakespeare.
Let's talk about him.
Did you know that William Shakespeare appears in Earth 311 in the Marvel Universe?
No.
It's Marvel 1602.
Oh, okay.
That might make a little more sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, it's a story that is set in England, so of course you would have Shakespeare show up. Do you know that William Shakespeare, Robot, appears in Earth 616?
No, but that sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, he is a robot that is based on the original William Shakespeare, who was built by the Mad Thinker and severely damaged by our boy Captain America.
Oh.
And when he was rebuilt, he no longer had a face. Sad trombone.
It's a sad, sad story.
Do you know that William Shakespeare has written comic books?
William Shakespeare has not written comic books.
Oh, well, I'm looking here at classical comics, and they have Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, A Midsummer Night's Dream, The Tempest, and Henry V right here.
Yeah.
And can we talk about Magna Shakespeare, Much Ado About Nothing, which
yes.
has 4.5 stars on Amazon?
Okay.
So even this story has made it into comics.
Yeah, I believe it's made it into comics. I just don't believe we're going to talk too much about it because I haven't read it. Have you?
No, we're not going to talk about it at all. I just want to point out, because you think we're not going to talk much about comics, that William Shakespeare is, in fact, like you, a comic book author.
I would say he is neither a comic book author or like me. But
I was trying to give you some credit.
I hear what you're saying, though, and that's I'll say this. I've read some Shakespeare graphic novels, and again, when you can see the faces and see the emotions, it's so much easier to understand. So,
all right, let's move off the writer and let's talk about the director,
who is also credited as writing. This.
Well, because he did adapt it.
Yes, he did. He did walk through the script and mark out lines.
Now, he largely stayed true to it.
Yes, he did.
Other than, you know, shortening some stuff. There is one section that he did completely rewrite because it makes reference to, well, what can be considered in a racial comment where I believe Benedict says if he doesn't love her, he might be a Jew. Yeah. And he did change that too. I would be a fool. But otherwise, he's pretty much following along with the original Shakespeare. And what he's done is he's cut it. He's flexed it a little bit, but he really hasn't touched it much.
Right. Well, and this is what Joss Whedon, I mean, his first job is to figure out how to make it a watchable film. And I guess at the end, do we have to wait until the end to decide, you know, to tell people what we think about it being a watchable film, or can we talk about that right now? But it's his job to go through and say, okay, this is important. This is important. He's adapting the script. But
I do think when he's adapting it, he's done this with love. When you read and you hear him talking about it, he has a passion for this. And when you hear him talk, it may have actually reinvigorated him for movie making. Because it sounds like he began to question what he thought about story and whether or not he was a good storyteller. And this was a project, a passion project that really kind of brought him back to the things that he loved about story.
So this is our man, Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
And
director of Avengers.
Director of Avengers. He's working on this while he's working on Avengers.
Well, and
a little bit.
So the production itself, well, let's go back to how this even happens. He started showing an interest in Shakespeare by having friends over, many of them who had starred in his television shows, mm-hmm. over to his house largely on Sundays, and they would literally read Shakespeare. And the house that he currently lives in, which was built by his wife, actually has an amphitheater in it. And Joss's job was to cast folks and direct them, but they were literally, you know, book in hand, reading Shakespeare on Sunday afternoons and having fun.
And they cast it beforehand, though, so they actually had a few days to read through and check out their lines and figure out what it is that they're actually saying.
And one of these that they did was Much Ado About Nothing, with Amy Acker as Beatrice and Alexis Denisov as Benedict. And at one point he decided if we're going to ever make one of these into the movie, this is the one we have to do just because of how well they did in the leads.
Mm-hmm. Although our boy Clark Gregg was not a part of that.
No.
In fact, it sounds like he was never a part of the readings at all.
No. This is where we'll get into this. This is our Avengers connections. We have more than one. So this is really where it started, is the fact that he's in love with Shakespeare. And if you watch some of the making ofs, you'll see production assistants talk about how while he was making the Avengers, he actually sent somebody out to go get him a copy of Much Ado so he could start marking it up and begin mm-hmm. his casting. And he was casting while he was doing post-production of Avengers.
And then they filmed it during a contractual two-week vacation away from Avengers.
The principal filming was done in exactly 12 days.
Yes.
At his house.
What a nice house that is, by the
way. It is a really nice house, but I will say there is a scene where it literally looks like Benedict and Claudio are checking in in a guest room that has been overrun with small stuffed animals. And I wrote down in my notes, what did he do? Film this at his house? And then I found out afterwards he filmed it at his house. Yeah,
he did. You know, they're staying in the girls' room. You know, they've got the Barbie doll house with Barbie sitting in it. But again,
what Whedon has done here is instead of setting it in the 16th century, he does set it in modern day surroundings, and he uses his own home. And so he does adapt things. So instead of swords, you know, you will have guns, for example. But it really does. It seems like businessmen checking in and staying mm-hmm. over at another gentleman's house.
Yep.
Because, you know, they're just checking into one of the guest rooms or, you know, one of the daughter's rooms.
Yep.
So you do have to laugh a little bit as you watch these two grown men sit on little tiny twin beds covered in stuffed animals.
And talk about love. You know, this is later on in the movie, but it's I'm reminded of, you know, teenage girls, you know, in an 80s movie, you know, sitting in their old room, talking about love on the phone, you know, and being schoolgirls. And it's just it's fun.
In many ways, it does show, even though the language is, you know, older English, how well the concepts do travel forward into our time. How really Shakespeare, in many ways, was ageless in the fact that you can take his original setting and translate it into a today setting, and it still makes sense.
Yeah, and some plays it works better than others, and in this situation, I don't think it works badly. This does not hinge on history.
No,
it takes place in a historical point in time. You know, that Shakespeare had in mind. It's not just an amorphous thing like King Lear, which I think I'm going to come back to a few times as we're talking about different characters and things. But King Lear takes place in this kind of prehistory fantasy world almost. I mean, and that's where King Lear, because it's vague, you can translate it into a number of different places, you know, Old West, far future, whatever. And this is another one that because it's kind of vague, you're able to translate it and transplant it. And I don't mind it so much in this situation. There's some other Shakespeare things where I'm just like, oh, really? Okay, whatever. Just as long as performances are good. But this I can live with, and actually I can go along with it here. So, and I'll also say I'm not a Shakespeare snob or a Shakespeare scholar. It's been years since I've studied Shakespeare. But, coming into this, I'm also kind of overwhelmed by the language and just by the story itself. So, so Joss Whedon at his house with his friends. He's bringing in a cast of friends. This man's friends are some of the most talented people. it's an interesting caliber of friends that he has.
I don't know that for sure, just because, again, most of these folks I haven't seen much because I, except for Firefly, have not delved deep into the Whedonverse. So in many ways, a character like Dogberry, which Nathan Fillion plays, to me, I say, why isn't Nathan Fillion the star? Because he's the one out of all these folks that I know, other than Clark Gregg and Chrissy Seaver. So,
Chrissy Seaver, I can't believe that.
We're almost there. Almost there with Avengers Connection.
All right.
So our Avengers Connections production started during Avengers. Whedon began his planning, began making his phone calls for casting, where he was literally asking folks if they would want to do it and if they'd be willing to do it quick. So they didn't have a lot of time, and they didn't have a lot of time to film. It sounds like when you look at some of the interviews that most of these folks had the same sort of reaction, which is if Joss calls you, you just say yes.
I think I heard that four times verbatim from four different people.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
Now, two actors in this list of characters, they did appear in the Avengers. One of them is Clark Gregg.
Yes.
So our beloved Agent Coulson is in this movie, but originally wasn't planning on being in it because Anthony Head, who I believe was in Buffy.
I would say yes, I think so.
He was in his, you know, a Whedon staple. He was originally supposed to be cast as Leonardo, and he was unable to do it. But after working with Gregg on the Avengers, he asked him if he'd be willing to come and fill that role.
And the other Avengers connection?
Chrissy Seaver.
Wait, what?
Dude, you need to wake up. Ashley Johnson is in the Avengers as the waitress.
I knew that the waitress was in this show, in this movie. I did not know that was Chrissy Seaver, though.
It is Chrissy Seaver.
Why in the world?
And where the connection is when they were filming the Avengers, she saw him carrying around a copy of Much Ado About Nothing, and they had a conversation about it. And then a few weeks later, after she was done with her scene, she received a phone call from Joss saying, hey, do you want to come out here and film Much Ado About Nothing? And she jumped at it.
Wow. Okay. Chrissy Seaver was in Avengers. Interesting.
Exactly.
My favorite this Seaver was always Ben Seaver, for obvious reasons.
So last but not least, I do think we need to make a comment about the style that this has been filmed in, which is this is a black and white movie.
It is.
So what did you think about that?
I think that it's easier to light in some ways. And, you know, you don't have to worry about certain things. You know, you're just taking off a whole level of post-production and pre-production by getting rid of color. Because you're able to, you know, not worry about, okay, how does the palette work here? And so there, on one hand, just from a technical standpoint, I think that that might have even made things a little easier for them. I think that's why a lot of indie film is black and white. I like black and white movies. I like modern black and white movies. I like it when it's a choice and not just, you know, that's the only way we could film Citizen Kane because that's all that was available. But I like it as a stylistic choice. Sometimes it feels kind of, I'll just go ahead and use the word pretentious, even though as soon as you use the word pretentious, you're being pretentious.
You're so pretentious.
Why? Because I use the word pretentious?
Absolutely.
But see, as soon as you call me pretentious, you're being pretentious, but then I'm being it again by saying you are. So it's this vicious, wild circle.
It's like a paradox.
Yes.
That like you'd find in a comic book.
It's the dragon eating its tail. But
I do find it interesting, though, you brought up the production piece, because one of the points that some of the cast made about being in black and white is that since they were filming it at Joss's house, that if somebody's orange lawnmower was in the background, they'd never had to worry about it.
Right.
And there were things that were obscured just because they were in black and white, so you couldn't make them out as clearly, which did literally help in post-production.
And some of the things I was seeing about the lighting, I mean, they used a lot of natural lighting. They reflected the sun and used that a lot rather than bringing in, you know, huge, you know, lighting rigs. And so just from a production standpoint, they were doing everything they could to make it fast and cheap a production. And so there's that practical standpoint. From a stylistic point of view, I'm thinking to myself, I don't know. It gives it a grittier feel. And I know that they were trying to get away from your traditional Shakespeare movie, you know, which is just this big, colorful, bright, you know, period piece kind of thing. And so they're filming in black and white. You're definitely on the other end of the spectrum from that. But I like black and white movies.
And I'm okay with black and white movies. I actually, again, I grew up at a time, kids, where black and white was what we had as a TV. I prefer my color. I'm good with it. But I understand, again, that this was a passion project for them. So when I look at this, I don't look at it as being something on the Avengers, which you would have never done in black and white. I mean, they have some freedom to play with this because it's cheap budget, quickly done.
A little experimental for him.
A little definitely. And he even makes the point that if he was to do another Shakespeare movie at a later time, it would be nothing like this one. Mm-hmm. In an interview that I saw him. The other piece is because he is looking at this as being a film noir because there's some black comedy going on throughout this thing. So it made sense to film it in black and white, which many of the film noirs are in.
You've got Avengers, which is your bright, full-color mainstream comic. And then you've got Much Ado About Nothing, which becomes your black and white indie underground type of comic. You know, and you're looking at, you know, like Blankets or manga even. But I'm trying to think of some other titles that are black and white. Mouse. and that kind of thing. So this is more of your, again, indie, underground, punk rock almost, in a way, just the way they're pulling it together so quickly and just doing it. And it's a passion project rather than a, you know, we're going to storyboard every single second of this sucker. But here's some other things they get to do with the black and white. You have, when you're watching a black and white movie, you have stark contrast. And in this story, Much Ado About Nothing, there is a lot of stark contrasts between characters. And I don't want to talk too much about Benedict and his transformation, but it uses the black and white palette very, very nicely. So we'll get into why when we get to it, but when we get to him, I should say.
So should we get into a basic description of the story? And I mean really, really basic.
Yeah. Sure.
All right. Let's see if I can plow through this quickly in under 2 minutes. Put a timer on me.
Okay. We could just use the official website description of the story.
Fine. That makes sense.
Did you have something you wanted to read?
No.
Did you write it out?
No. No, I was just going to make it up as I went.
Oh, let's not do that.
Fine. Yeah. Let's not do that.
This is from the official website, themuchadomovie.com. Leonardo, Clark Gregg, the governor of Messina, is visited by his friend Don Pedro, Reed Diamond, who is returning from a victorious campaign against his rebellious brother, Don John, played by Sean Maher. I'm not a Whedonite. I'm sorry. I don't know these names very well. Accompanying Don Pedro are two of his officers, Benedict, Alexis Denisoff, and Claudio, Fran Kranz. While in Messina, Claudio falls for Leonardo's daughter, Hero, Jillian Morghese. While Benedict verbally spars with Beatrice, Amy Acker, the governor's niece. The budding love between Claudio and Hero prompts Don Pedro to arrange with Leonardo for a marriage. In the days leading up to the ceremony, Don Pedro, with the help of Leonardo, Claudio, and Hero, attempts to sport with Benedict and Beatrice in an effort to trick the two into falling in love. Meanwhile, the villainous Don John, with the help of his allies Conrad, Ricky Lindholm, and Baracchio, Spencer Treat Clark, plots against the happy couple, using his own form of trickery to try to destroy the marriage before it begins. A series of comic and tragic events may continue to keep the two couples from truly finding happiness, but then again, perhaps love may prevail. How's that?
That seems like a good summary of it.
I think it's a great summary. Better than anything I could have written, which is why I went ahead and suggested this, because I did consider trying to write one. And
you know me, I was going to just make something up as I went along, and it would have just been a hot mess of words and craziness, and I would have forgotten something.
Yep. You managed to do it. Nice job.
Dude, you knew it was coming.
I didn't, actually. It didn't even cross my mind. Talking about Much Ado About Nothing.
It wouldn't be special if it wasn't there.
Maybe.
So let's talk about some of these characters.
Yes.
And break it down. And we'll probably get into some plot pieces as we go, as we always do. And we're not going to talk about everybody.
Right. But we're going to talk about some characters and actors. And we're not scholars. So we're going to talk about our impressions of them. And when we get to the end, we're going to talk about if we think you would enjoy this movie. So...
So first up, man. Benedict, who is really, really the star of this movie. I mean, he is the central male character.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you almost get the feeling when you start that it's really about Hero and Claudio, it really is about Beatrice and Benedict.
Yeah, and I would actually go so far as to say Beatrice is the lead.
See, I think they're co-leads.
But she just can't really actually be the lead as far as Shakespeare's concerned because she's a woman.
Yeah, she was a man, though, in the original. Yeah. But let's be honest. I feel like they're co-leads, especially in this version.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Hero and Claudio love story is nice enough and all, and we'll get to that. But it's, what you're really interested in is what's going to happen with these two crazy kids whose names start with B.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the ones who have the most contrasting personalities, but yet similar. And they're definitely the two where there's the most relational conflict occurring. So let's go ahead and throw Beatrice into this discussion too, played by Amy Acker.
Yes. So here's what we have. We have Benedict, who is really he's a
player,
sexist pig. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't have anything. He has no reason to want women in his life other than for the thrill that they give him. And you get the impression, and Joss Whedon really brings this out. In the original, there's just one line that Beatrice drops that suggests they may have had a romantic interlude at some point in the past, and that's kind of part of why, even though they're made for each other, they have no interest in each other, is that that's gone sour, especially for Beatrice. Whedon goes ahead and makes the subtle thing and makes it very evident.
Subtle? Okay, I was going to say, it's not subtle at the beginning.
It's not
of the
subtle
movie.
With Joss, no, but it is subtle in the original, where now we actually see at the prologue, there they are, doing their thing together. And then in the middle, when she's talking about and drops the line where he pulled this from, you see a flashback to them having a very physical relationship. And so now they hate each other. And we want to know what's going to happen. They're funny. She is really sarcastic and kind of,
well, and she's wicked smart.
Mean, yeah. And she's able to cut to the quick with her words. She's brilliant, you know, and they and he does the same. The difference is, you know, he's not quite he doesn't come across to me as quite as clever, but he still he keeps up with the wordplay. So, but she definitely seems to have the upper hand when it comes to all that.
Well, and I get the feeling that he's not used to finding someone who's his equal in the wordplay. And maybe that's one of the reasons why he seems to be a little bit behind, is because I don't think he knows how to react to finding someone who can keep up with him and beat him.
That might be part of it. And the other thing is, I wonder how many people even try with him.
Yeah, because I get the sense that he is, you know, they call him at one point the Joker, that he is someone who is used to being the funny, smart one.
Yeah.
And having someone else who's trying to fill that role is something that's almost a threat to him.
So they hate each other, and he has no use for women. He does not want to get married. He says he's going to die a bachelor, and that's his plan, to die a bachelor. Of course, then his buddy Claudio has just lost it for Hero, and so Benedict is, you know, betrayed in a way by Claudio. You know, he says, you know, will I never see another 30-year-old bachelor? The impression being that all of his friends are getting married except for him. And he's going to lose Claudio as well.
Well, and the good thing is as an audience member, you know these two are meant to be together. You feel it. But also the cast feels that. And you get these great moments where you have a conspiracy to bring Benedict and Beatrice together. And to convince them that the other one loves them with an intense and unspeakable, because they would never speak of it,
right,
burning passion. And it leads you to some really, really humorous scenes where you've got, you know, Benedict lying on the ground, hiding behind a branch that he's holding up.
And doing army rolls to keep out of sight while they know he's there, because that's the whole reason they're talking. Or the funniest thing to me about that scene being, when it's all done and they walk away and he stands up and he says, it can't be a trick, because, you know, they're just having the conversation, you know, and it's just really funny. That's the first thing out of his mouth. And I'm watching this and imagining in some ways, well, how is a live studio audience, or, you know, at the Globe, the audience, they're reacting to that, you know, can't be a trick. And just the laughter that would happen right there. Because
exactly, a live audience is part of the conspiracy.
Yeah.
When you're in the play, you know what's going on, and Benedict doesn't. So you are part of that experience.
And so then you have Benedict convincing himself, you know, why it's okay. I thought I was going to die a bachelor, but really that's because I thought I was going to die before I had a chance to get married. And then he's, you know, the human race must, you know, must propagate or whatever. I mean, he's convincing himself why it's okay to go against everything and do a complete 180.
Because of a rumor that a lady loves him.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does. You begin to see this change of character in the sense of him probably doing things he wouldn't do before. There's a scene in which he does push-ups to show his manliness. And that was an improv scene that even Joss questioned. But in the end, he decided to keep it in there. But really, when you look at that scene, it's like you've got a flamingo throwing up his feathers to show off.
Yeah.
As he's kind of sitting there with his legs open and doing things like sit-ups and push-ups in order.
Yeah, the stretches and the...
Look at how manly I am.
Well, and we've seen that scene played out before. We've seen people doing that on TV, in sitcoms, like Growing Pains, you know? You might have seen that kind of thing. It's funny, and it was surprising to me. When I first watched this a couple months ago, when I thought we were going to be doing this, I was surprised at how funny that scene played out, because it starts out, he's convincing himself to love her. She comes out. He starts acting all tough and macho and talking to her, thinking that she's trying not to let me know. And so you have these layers. The audience knows that he's been lied to. He thinks he knows something she doesn't know. So when she comes and she's mean to him, he's reading a double meaning into everything she's saying. And then when she, you know, she's talking to him, she has no clue what's going on. And so you have these layers of knowledge and layers of deceit and layers of just information. And it's nice. It's fun. It's funny. And then add to it all the physical stuff that he's doing. It's good. So next, that's the other thing I was going to say about using the color palette. Before this point, and up until this point, where he's trying to impress her, he's wearing all black, and he has a beard. And after this scene, where you have the guys who tricked him coming in and talking to him, and he's trying to convince them that you know, he has a toothache. That's why he's acting the way he is. But he's clean shaven, and he's not wearing white necessarily, but he's wearing a very, very light colored, whatever color it might be, it ends up being gray, a light gray shirt. And it's meant to be that sharp contrast between who he was before, no use for women, especially Beatrice, and who he is now, where he's almost convinced himself he's in love with her because she's in love with him.
Well, and he gets to the point where he will do anything, including killing one of his best friends in Claudio.
Yeah. So,
I mean, he goes from having no use for our women to having sacrificing everything for one woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he's a classic character in Shakespeare. He's a character I knew about just from taking, you know, English classes. You know, I never read this play, never saw it, but I knew about him and Beatrice just because that's what you, when you're studying Shakespeare, they come up. So
since these are our leads, what did you think of their performances?
I like them. Now, I have never, in my memory, I've never seen Alexis. Amy Acker I knew from Dollhouse, and I liked her a lot in Dollhouse. And so, yeah, as far as the performances go, I think Amy Acker pretty much outperforms everyone in this, because she has the most to work with. She gets, you know, her classic speech where she expresses her love to Benedict. But that's also where she's expressing her outrage at what's happened with Claudio and Hero. And she's so angry because she's a woman and she can't do what she would want to do to make things right and everything. And so she has that, which just there's a broad range between the sharp wit that she has and then the kind of introspection that she has as she's trying to figure out what's going on with her and Benedict. And then also this rage and sorrow that she has about her cousin Hero and Claudio. I think she outperforms everyone in this thing. So,
and I agree. She shines. She's the probably the one that I never had an issue with her performance. Compared to everybody else, there was times where it just didn't necessarily feel like it was on. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was a pacing issue or just a tone issue. Where for her, I always liked her character, and I always felt like she performed it well.
And Benedict, he has comic timing. He's funny. As far as his performance goes, though, I'm not going to give him the award that I gave to her, you know, because it's there. It's funny. I don't know anything about him. I don't know anything about what he plays or who he's played in the past. I imagine he plays a lot of funny roles. But the role itself didn't give him as much to work with, and he plays it broad. He plays for the broad comedy, and it works. But again, like I said, it's just not – he doesn't have as many chances to shine as she has. And if he did, I don't know if he'd be able to keep up with her in that.
You do realize he was on Dollhouse.
He was?
Yeah, Senator Daniel Perrin.
Oh, okay. So he was like one of the guys who hired a doll or something.
He's on for four separate episodes,
though. Okay, well, maybe he's not. I don't know. It's been years since I've seen Dollhouse.
And he was on How I Met Your Mother with his wife, Allison Hannigan, where he played Sandy Rivers, which I believe that was a pretty funny role. Hmm. But I'll be honest. For me, and I don't want to sound like I disliked it completely, but there was times, especially in the first half of the movie, where I don't know if it was the tone of his voice or his pacing, where it seemed much more like a reading than a portrayal to me.
I could see that. And there were plenty of times when I saw that kind of thing in other people where it felt more like a reading than a performance. But I felt like he was playing a comedy performance. And in times when it wasn't funny, I don't feel he had as much to work with, or I feel like he didn't feel like he has much to work with. So I could see what you're saying. Absolutely.
Well, there's one pair.
There is one pair. Is there anything else to say about that pair other than they keep sparring and they do get together? I mean, this is Shakespeare and it's a comedy.
I was worried. No, not so much with this group. I'm worried in the next group about going Romeo and Juliet on us. But I really – Amy Acker shines. And again, I'm somebody who hasn't seen her in much.
Here's the thing about Shakespeare's comedies is they usually end at a wedding, sometimes more than one. you just going in, the couples are going to get together. And so, you know, spoiler, but that's what's going to happen. And it's just, how is it going to happen?
Well, I didn't know those couples were going to get together because with our next group, I thought Hero and Claudio, that one of them, if not both, wasn't going to make it. I was convinced Claudio was going to commit suicide.
But this is a comedy. That's the thing. It's not a tragedy. So
I was on the edge of my seat, terrified that he was going to do something stupid.
Okay, so let's talk about Claudio and Hero then. You want to talk about the actors first?
No, I know nothing about them.
Okay. And again,
I know nothing about Fran Kranz. Again, this summer I might become familiar with him as we go through some things.
Well, Fran Kranz was Dollhouse. I knew him from Dollhouse. I knew him from the horror movie.
Apparently, I should know him from Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Broderick Rules.
Oh, really? Cabin in the Woods, I think?
Ooh, that's scary. You know my philosophy on that.
Is that what the name of it was, though?
Yep, it's the Cabin in the Woods.
Okay. Cabin in the Woods, I know him from that. And, you know, another Whedon project that he didn't direct, but he wrote. And, I knew him from those things. I liked him from both of those things, although... no spoilers for Cabin in the Woods, but there's reasons why I turned against that movie and him at the end. But that's another conversation for another day that maybe we'll have, maybe we won't.
We're not going to have that with me here.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Maybe we won't. Turns into we won't right now. Yeah. And so I liked him coming in. Jillian Morghese, I don't know who she is.
Nope.
Never heard of her. That's interesting. I just clicked on her IMDb.
Uh-oh.
She's in Much Ado About Nothing and in The Avengers as Woman in Restaurant. And Zombies, A Living History, TV movie documentary. She plays a ghoul. Interesting. I wonder.
Please notice the Woman in Restaurant is uncredited.
Right. I wonder, though, because they're talking about the readings that they were giving. And he said it's, you know, Joss Whedon said it started out where he's bringing in, you know, other actors and things like that from his show. But then they started bringing spouses and friends and stuff like that. And so I wonder if she actually got this role, and maybe even the role in The Avengers, because she was actually a part of some of those readings.
Well, and that makes good sense because, I mean, he rose a very prominent role in this movie. And she really is the least known out of all the cast. And I think she does a fine job. And so maybe she was part of that original Much Ado About Nothing reading when she was brought in as a friend or a spouse. So
yeah. I'm very curious now about her, having looked at her IMDb. It's very interesting. And because the thing is, she holds her own. I mean, she spends most of her time either with Fran Kranz or Amy Acker. And so she's spending a lot of her time with, as I've already said, the strongest performance of the movie.
And it's
but
not
she
like
doesn't look bad.
No, it's not like she's getting lost in the room.
Nope.
Because I do think she did. Hero as a character, I think, is very likable. And she's definitely a contrast to Beatrice.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest. I mean, I thought she did a great job because she did what she needed to do, which was to make us like Hero and understand that Hero was a person of high moral values and a person who would not be doing naughty, naughty things.
Right. Which is where we have their problem. They start, it's kind of the inverse. You know, Beatrice and Benedict start out hating each other and then toward the middle realize they love each other. Whereas Claudio and Hero start out at the beginning just enamored with each other, just completely and utterly enamored. And then in the middle of it, you know, Claudio wants her to die.
Well, and Claudio doesn't come off as very smart because there's two incidents in here in which he is lied to about his forthcoming wedding. And the first one is eliminated pretty quick where he's told that Don Pedro actually was attempting to arrange a marriage between him and Hero instead of Claudio and Hero. And, I mean, that's a situation that is – I mean, it takes seconds to relieve that situation. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
So you would think that at this point he would realize that there's someone trying to mess with him.
Well, that's the thing. Claudio gets lied to a lot and believes it every time.
Yeah. So I wanted to like Claudio because he seems like a nice enough gentleman. But at the same time, you're not smart because the villain – I mean, the villain literally, it's not like the villain is holding you hostage. It's not like the villain's holding anyone to the gun to their head. The villain is a villain because the villain lies. And Claudio just eats it up.
He doesn't, goes along with it.
And he doesn't necessarily believe his friends. He doesn't believe that their interests are his interests, that they're looking out for him. I mean, when you think about his reaction to Don Pedro, it's like, you know, this guy's been with you for years.
Claudio is a leaf in the wind.
Yeah.
Claudio gets blown whichever way the people who are around him are going to blow him. They're going to, you know, say, hey, you know, Hero cheated on you. Now, he gets visual proof of this cheating, but it's a lie. He believes it. And then at the end, like, hey, you've got to marry one of my, you know, one of my nieces or whatever, to make up for what you've done to Hero. And he's okay. And he just goes along with it. He believes the lies. He just goes along with them. honestly.
You're absolutely right, because that's another lie.
Yeah, no, totally. The very end of the movie is just his, the climax of Claudio and Hiro's story is another lie. And he just goes along with it, and it turns out fine for him. But I'm telling you, Hiro gets the bum end of the deal.
She's stuck with Claudio.
And it's either going to be a nice marriage where she's just, hey, Claudio, let's go do this. And he's like, okay, you know, and he goes and does it. Now, he gets a good deal, though, because he's Leonardo's heir, right? Because Leonardo didn't have any sons.
Nope, he only had a daughter. And yeah. In fact, even after it all comes out that his actions have quote-unquote killed Hiro because Hiro's heart couldn't take it. And so basically I'm trying to think, the father, is that a good way to say it? The religious man?
The priest, yeah.
The priest.
Yeah, the friar, I think they call him the friar.
He says, you know, pretend that Hiro has died.
Let's lie to him some more.
Because that worked out well in Romeo and Juliet. But let's pretend that Hiro's died because her heart couldn't take it. If you really, really killed my daughter, my child, why would you go back to the guy who quote unquote killed and say, oh, here's the deal. I'm still going to let you be my heir and have all of my fabulous money and holdings by marrying my niece.
Yeah.
I mean,
but you know, they present the brides or the bride rather to him, and they all have their face covered, and so he's yeah okay sure you know she looks okay you know I can't see her face but yeah so then she lifts the veil or whatever and he sees that she's still alive but yeah so that's Claudio and Hiro. And so what do you think of their performances? We talked a little bit about that, but let's talk about Hiro with Jillian.
Hiro, she did well. Originally, I thought that more of the story was going to be about her than it is. And she definitely doesn't get lost compared to anyone else. Claudio, I thought his performance was okay, but I'll be honest, I just didn't like his character. So in the sense of, I thought you were supposed to be a nice guy, but you're so stupid.
Well, and he's not nice. That's the other thing is when he... Okay, so Hiro has been framed.
Yeah,
Hiro's been framed by a guy and Hiro's maid servant or whatever you want to call her. They're in the window making out. And Claudio sees them making love. He sees their... Again, this is good use of the black and white where you have the nice silhouette in the window. But the woman is wearing one of Hiro's gowns, and he believes it's Hiro who's cheating on him the night before their wedding. And so when he goes and accuses her at the wedding ceremony, you know, they're doing basically it's, do you take this woman? No, because you know what she was doing last night. He's totally accusing her. And even as she fights against him, and says, no, it's not true. It's not true. He won't hear anything of it. Of course, he saw it. I guess, I mean, which way do you go with that? Do you trust her or do you trust your own eyes? But he's not nice to her at all. And it's not the verbal sparring that you get from Beatrice and Benedict. It's it's mean.
Just let me say, as someone who has nearly 20 years of marital experience, believe your wife.
Here's the thing, if she's lying and that really was her in the window, you have to ask yourself, why would she tell such a lie? And is she trustworthy? It kind of goes back to Chronicles of Narnia kind of thing where the professor says to them, you know, Lucy says that she went into the wardrobe and found a magical land. Edmund says he went in and saw nothing. And the professor's like, well, who's more likely to lie? You know, Hiro is chaste and she's virtuous. She would not lie. But Claudio is able just just immediately turn on her and not
trust. He's a moron.
So, but played well. I'll say that Fran Kranz, he does a great job with the part, and makes you not like him.
He's a mean moron. Spiteful.
Yes.
Stupid.
Who feels bad about it somewhat at the end, but yeah. Okay. But that's only how much of it is him feeling bad because he thinks she's dead. I killed her.
Well, he's a nice enough guy. I mean,
he's a great guy once he thinks that he's, you know, committed a mortal sin.
Sorry, I killed your daughter. Yeah. Thanks for the money.
Okay. So anything more about Claudio and Hero?
No, let's move on to the Dons. Don Johnson and Don John.
Don Johnson. We have Don Sean, actually. Don John, played by Sean. So Don John, I'm reminded with this character of, I want to say his name is Edmund, actually, from King Lear, the bastard son. You know, and the bastard son is used in Shakespeare because, you know, you have that in the court. You know, he's the son. I mean, he's Claudio's brother, basically, right? I believe that they're brothers, but he has no legal standing for any kind of. No, he's the brother of Don Pedro. Don Pedro and Don John are brothers, and so Claudio is not a part of what I'm saying at all. But Don Pedro is a prince, and so Don John can't be a prince. There's no chance for him to be a king. Because he's illegitimate, he's the bastard son, and he's base, and that's what happens in Shakespeare. Is if you're a bastard son, you're a base man, you're a bad guy, and so he just wants people to be unhappy. He does what he wants, where he wants, when he wants. So Don John, played by Sean Maher. I'm having a horrible time saying these names. I'm really sorry. Can you imagine being in my classroom on the first day of school? You wouldn't have a bad time of it, Daniel Butcher. But I'm going to tell you right now, I butchered names so bad. I hated the first day of school when my kids would come in and I get their names all wrong. So anyway, what'd you think of...
So I will say this. Since you're the one who's been jumping in with these names before I can in most cases, someday in the future, I know we'll have a Boba Fett / Hawk conversation and I will remind you of this night. I'm just going to say it right now. You'll be reminded.
Except for one thing, and that's that I haven't spent my entire life hearing these names said over and over again.
Well, I've heard them properly in my ears. So what did I think of Don John? So did you know that this was Sean Mayer's first time playing a villain?
I did know that. I did, because I watched the behind-the-scenes documentary thing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, it was the first time. In a lot of what they've said is that he was natural.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, he's not on scene a lot. He's kind of the puppet master in the back. And then he goes on the run when everything's going down. So you don't even really get to see him get his comeuppance, except on a video phone. Just like on TMZ. So, I mean, I don't know. I felt it was okay.
He's swarmy enough when he needs to be, but he's one of the weaker performances in the movie, I think.
Here was the test for me. Okay. Last week on Arrow, he played Shrapnel.
Oh, okay.
So I guess that would be the second time he played a villain.
Yeah. Yep.
And it totally didn't work for me. It didn't. I didn't think it was a strong performance at all. It seemed like not somebody who had been on the fantastic cast of Firefly. It seemed like a guest star that they had brought in to fill a role and just get him in and get him out. Yeah. It didn't at all feel like it was special, which it should have been special. And then it should have been a performance that we were just overwhelmed with. And that's kind of the way I feel about Don John is, you know, he was there, he was in the room, he said the lines. He didn't get out and get done.
Yeah. You know, Joss Whedon talking about him on the documentary was talking about how good looking he is. You know, how has he not played a villain before? you know, look at him. He's sexy, you know. I just wonder if he just doesn't have as broad of a range, you know, or is it just that the material's not there for him? And he's kind of, you know, coming into this very quickly, like everyone else, and, you know, not having enough time to prepare, or maybe not having enough to work with in the character. I don't know. I'll also say this, though. This character is weak. The character itself is weak. He's evil to be evil, it feels like. There's no real motivation other than he doesn't like his brother because his brother's legitimate. I don't know. But, yeah. And so I know when Sean listens to this episode of the podcast, as he's been listening,
Well, here's the thing,
he's going to say, how are they talking bad about me? I was on Firefly and they love Firefly.
We think you're a rock star. We just don't think that this or Arrow, in my case, was your best work. We want you to stay the likable good guy.
Yeah.
Because you are a handsome man just like me. And apparently I can play villains.
He is a man just like you.
Yes. Handsome man just like me. Well, so let's talk real quick about his brother, Don Pedro.
Let's do that.
Played by Reed Diamond, who had a stellar performance in Moneyball as baseball general manager Mark Shapiro.
I don't know who this guy is, you know.
Well, and the
he was in Spider-Man apparently, but
no, he's part. He's, I mean, in he's got tons.
He was in Dollhouse.
Tons of TV credits.
He was in Dollhouse. I do not remember him.
Tons of television credits, though. I mean, he's got a lot of stuff. He's been very big. He's getting paid. He's working. You know?
Again, looking at IMDb, I'm seeing he's in Journeyman. I loved Journeyman. He was the friend in Journeyman. I remember him now.
Again, Mark Shapiro. I remember last time I watched Moneyball, I sent you messages throughout the entire thing, and you had no idea what any of them meant.
Yeah. I have, until now, looking through, I had no idea who this guy was, but I feel like I've seen him all, you know, I feel like I've seen his face. I know his face. I just didn't know him. Now I realize I did know him. He was on Stargate SG-1.
Well, and I'll be honest, I liked him. I thought he did an excellent job. His character was one that I thought it sold. I found him likable. I found him somebody that I'd want to have as a friend. And I think he sold it. I think he did well.
I will agree with you. I think he's in the upper rankings of you know, just the strength of the cast.
He may have put in my opinion, the third best performance in this movie.
First being Amy Acker.
Second being Hero.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, you heard it right there. Telegraphing.
See, I would have put Hero at maybe number 4 and put Don Pedro, Reed Diamond, at number 3. My number 2 I have saved for a special person.
Is it time for your number 2?
Well, what's next? Oh, Leonardo? Is that who's next?
Leonardo.
He is not my number two. No.
He's not your number two. Ooh.
Yeah. Here's.
Ooh, I forgot somebody.
Yeah. We've got some controversy about to come up here.
Okay. So here's the thing.
I'm going to get controversial up in this place.
I'm going to shift Don Pedro down to 4.
Okay.
You're right.
Am I right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
So Leonardo, how'd you feel?
Clark Gregg, he's dressed in full on, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. gear of a suit and tie. I don't know, you know, I it pains me to say this.
So let's back up. I know you and I both watched some of the same makings of.
Mm-hmm.
So
watched the documentary that was on there, okay. That one.
Did you see the documentary in which one of the cast members was like, how do I do this? And then I saw Clark Gregg do it. And I was like, that's how you do it.
Yes,
I did.
Did
you see that one?
Mm-hmm.
What was your reaction when you heard that line?
The scene that they showed as he was talking about that line is the scene where Clark Gregg shines the most. In Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I've seen more emotional range in Clark Gregg and more powerful performances. Now,
again, he was brought in late, so let's give him some credit.
I'll give him that, but
I feel like it
felt weak. There's the scene where they're faking out Benedict, and I feel like I'm watching Clark Gregg acting. You know, I don't feel like he's owning the role. I don't feel like he is inhabiting the role. I feel like he's doing the role.
Yeah, let's be honest. It feels like he's reading.
Yeah. 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 Okay.
Yeah. So Leonardo is Hero's father. So Clark Gregg is dad. Very, very rich politician in this. All this action is occurring at his house. So it's not Joss's house. It's Coulson's house that all this is flying through. As a character, I do feel like he does sell that, you know, Leonardo is somewhat shallow. And I feel like maybe he should be coming off that way. He's shallow in the sense of he's concerned with the good things of life and enjoying life. But I also felt betrayed. And maybe this is one of the reasons why I've reacted strongly, because he doesn't believe his own daughter at a certain point. And it's like, you're Coulson. This is your kid. You know you raised her right, man. You know you raised her right. Is that me bringing too much over?
I think you're bringing a little too much over, you know.
Yeah.
But this isn't Sky we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, if it was Sky.
It's Hero.
I would have been furious. It feels like he's reading at times.
I don't want to say, you know, that he did a bad job, because he didn't do a bad job. But he's not up there with Amy Acker, and he's not, you know, when he's smiling, it feels like a put on smile in some of those places. And when he's reacting, it feels like he's, you know, trying to keep up with the reaction.
Here's where I'm satisfied, Ben. I learned something. I never need to see Agent Coulson dance.
Oh, I liked that.
Oh, I hated it.
I liked that, because are you talking about when they turn on the music?
Yeah.
And he's just kind of doing his little thing over.
Free-forming.
Yeah. No, I liked that. You know, there's parts about his performance that I liked. There's parts where I was just not – it wasn't very strong. But that doesn't come from him. You know, that's not me saying it's a limitation that he has, because honestly, I've seen more and better from him in other things.
You know what it feels like? Here's another thing. Along with it being a reader, I feel like he was brought in as a professional actor who could do the job.
It might be.
And not someone who was, I mean, he
part
didn't,
of the clique.
Didn't steal the show. He was not part of the clique. He's not as friendly with this group as everybody else. He was a professional actor that could come in and get these lines delivered. And dance goofy.
I'll tell you why I like that, because that's about as good as I can do. And I'm guessing he can do a lot better than that.
But I have a strict don't dance policy, and I think maybe he needs to have one too.
Okay, so that's Leonardo.
So, I mean, this is why we watched the movie, is because Clark Gregg was in it. And
honestly, it is. I mean, okay. If just Joss Whedon would not have been enough for us to do an episode about this movie.
I feel like I get more every Tuesday night. I really do. I feel like he brings it strong every Tuesday night. But again, this is a character on Tuesday nights that he knows that he's basically helped create.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
far more than any other Marvel character.
I mean, at this point, don't you feel like Coulson is probably 70% Clark Gregg? What's brought to the table?
Yes, I would say Coulson is 70% what Clark Gregg brought to it. Yeah. At this point, anyway, and that's because in the movies it was different writers, bringing different things, and so now it's. Okay, here's the culmination of all those different variations with one common denominator, and that's Clark Gregg. Yeah. So, yeah. So the limitation, I don't know why the performance is not very strong. Is it because of the timing? Is it because of the, you know, just the quickness of things? Is it because he was tired Is it because, you know, they mentioned drinking a lot? Maybe he just drank too much. I don't know.
Well, but, and there are some scenes where there's dancing and drinking occurring.
Yeah.
And I say to myself, I think they were probably really drinking right before this.
Well, I bring that up not because I don't necessarily think they were drinking while they were producing this. Joss Whedon talks about their table readings of the Shakespeare stuff and how it started out with it was more about the drinks and the cheese than it was about the Shakespeare. And then it turned into more about the Shakespeare than about the drinks. And the cheese was still there, though, which, man, a cheese spread in that house. I would just like to, you know, and I'm not talking about a cheese spread like Cheese Whiz. I'm talking about a spread of cheese sitting around a table reading Shakespeare with these guys, eating cheese. There are much worse things I can think of.
No, it's an incredible fun idea. It really is.
Okay.
So we're a little sad about Leonardo.
We are. The disappointment comes just from the anticipation of seeing him. And there was that level of just a letdown there. So, okay, so next.
Dogberry.
And Verges. Because they go together. You know, they're a pair.
Well, they're a comedy duo, like Abbott and Costello. Laurel and Hardy. Dogberry and Verges.
Yes. Dogberry, played by Nathan Fillion. And I'm going to say this right now. He's number two.
You know what? I would agree. He because he brings the funny.
He does.
He really does. There's a lot of tense moments in this movie, and really the Dogberry moments are the ones where you're allowed to relax. Just like when Sky dresses up as Melinda May. you can calm down. You can have a few moments of chuckle. The funny he brings is smart funny, though he does continually.
Though the character itself is not.
No, the character is very, very, very dumb. Dumber than Claudio.
Yeah, the first time I watched this, I actually went back and rewatched some of those scenes. As I'd watch the scene with Dogberry. He's, you know, the investigator. I'd watch the scene, and then I'd actually go back and rewatch it because I, like you said, you were laughing, although you weren't necessarily catching everything. I knew it was funny. And I was laughing, but I wanted to find out why it was funny. So I go back and rewatch it because, you know, I consider myself an intelligent person. But I also know, you know, I'm not the most intelligent person in the world. And I really wanted to catch what was going on. And I couldn't on the first viewing. So, yeah, Dogberry, a lot of it comes from the wordplay and from his humor comes from words that I wouldn't understand right away. And Nathan Fillion apparently did not understand right away either because he said the first thing he learned about Shakespeare.
Yeah, he wanted out. He tried to pull out of this thing completely.
He was nervous.
And because it was just the material was not something he was familiar with and it was something that scared him.
And he said the first thing he learned about Shakespeare was you got to figure out, you know, and learn the words. And then once you learn the meaning of the line, you can say the line, you know, with the right inflections and with the right emotion and that kind of thing. And so I'm just picturing Nathan Fillion, you know, he's had two successful TV series, successful for Castle being it's long lasting, successful for Firefly being it caught on and people loved it.
Three. Hello. Two guys, a girl in a pizza place.
Sure.
He was fantastic on that show.
I can't say I ever saw that show.
Well, he was a delight.
I will believe you about that. But I can just picture him, you know, just poring over this and trying to, you know, look up these words and find out what is it I'm actually saying? Why is this line funny? So,
well, and really why some of these lines are funny is because of the delivery, in the sense of what he is saying. If anyone else was saying it, might seem like it's actually accurate.
Yes.
But it's not. And it's because he definitely comes off as pompous know-it-all.
Mm-hmm.
who's saying things that sound accurate, but again, they're just not.
Well, and the other characters don't know what he's talking about.
And Virgis is eating it up.
Yeah.
And no. I think we've all seen this guy in our workplaces. I mean, especially at yours.
What do you
say?
That
would be you. That would probably be you, since you're pretty much a one-man shop. But.
Yeah. I'm the guy. Okay. But anyway.
So.
What were you saying before you started, insulting me? And making fun of my vocabularizing, which
maybe words out Barry and Burgess.
So yeah, I mean, this is the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of this. Although this being a comedy, they're not comic relief; they're just more of the comedy.
And to be honest, they're also a big part of revealing everything, because it's the constables under Dogberry's command that
not because of anything he's done, but
I mean, even when he comes to Leonardo and he's like, I've got these guys, you know, and I think they've done something wrong, and Leonardo's like, whatever, it's like, dude, just talk to him and he'll have your whole problem figured out in like 2 seconds.
Yep.
So, but of course, the only thing Dogberry is concerned with is the fact that he's been insulted. So,
yeah. So basically what we're saying here, Daniel, is that this is a movie worth watching because of Dogberry, because of Hero, and because of Beatrice.
Yep.
And if you think about it, that's almost 100% of the screen time, except for Benedict when he has his alone times. And even those are funny, because Benedict and Beatrice, that's one primary couple. Claudio and Hero, a second primary couple. And then Dogberry and Virgis, a third couple, not primary. But, you know, when they're on the screen, we're almost talking about 100% of the movie. We've got someone on the screen
from these pairs.
Definitely worth your time. So,
so overall impressions over for the story. I know you really liked it.
Yeah, I like the story a lot. Even though it's not one of my favorites, it's becoming one of my favorites because I've seen it now, Joss Whedon's version, 2.5 times. And, you know, and now I've dug into it, you know, to be able to talk about it. I like the story, but, you know, this movie is not one that I'm going to be coming back to over and over again. Like King Lear. King Lear I can watch over and over again. I love that story so much. So.
And I like the story. I think in many ways it's somewhat of a timeless story. Because, again, it's really based on romance and lies and people. But I think I would be more likely to try to read through it with this in my mind as kind of sight, you know, pictures to help me move through the story instead of watching it again. And I did say to, you know, Mrs. Butcher was interested, you know, should I watch this? And I said, I'm just going to take it back to Redbox because I think you're not going to dig it.
Okay.
So I'm, and for me again, and I mentioned this earlier, it's because it was hard for me to get into. I think some of the pacing, some of the tone, it sometimes felt like just clipped reading of lines to me at times.
So unlike our other Marvel movies that we've talked about, Daniel, I'm going to ask you a question that kind of comes into the kind of review side of things. And that is, who do you recommend this movie to? Who do you think is going to like this movie based on the way you've experienced it and the way you've reacted to it?
I think people who like indie films will like this. People who like experimental films will like this. I think people who like Joss Whedon movies and television programs will like it, because even if you're not fully understanding what's occurring, you will see familiar faces that will keep you engaged. I think back to high school, because in high school every year we read something Shakespeare, and of course the teacher then showed the movie. And I would say that at least 2, if not 3 of the movies that I saw were not as good a quality as this.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of bad quality Shakespeare movies.
So it's a good quality Shakespeare movie, but it's also not like I've got a library full of Shakespeare movies here.
Right. I would agree with that analysis. I enjoyed it, but I'm probably never going to come back to it.
And I find that interesting because I believe you were looking and considering purchasing it.
I was, and then I couldn't, and so I went to Redbox when I got groceries and got it out again, and I was rewatching it this time for this recording and just thinking, you know what? This is enough. I'm good. I enjoyed it. I've paid Redbox twice for it. And I'm happy. I liked it. I don't feel like it's wasted time. And I can't wait to start watching Buffy and Angel and saying, hey, that person is from Much Ado About Nothing.
Which I'm sure we will be saying.
I think it'll be funny because we'll be doing the opposite of what most people who like Joss Whedon are doing right now. They're watching Much Ado and saying, hey, another one from Buffy. So,
and so on my scale, I would actually give it a 3 out of 5. And what a 3 out of 5 for me is, it was okay. I would never buy it, but I didn't want to scratch my eyes out.
Okay.
It's a very, very visual description of what a 3 out of 5 is for me.
I would go with 4 out of 5, which is a B for me.
There you go.
It's a B. Recommendable, but not for everyone. And I think if you like Joss Whedon, you'll enjoy this movie at least once.
And if you like Joss Whedon, you really need to look at the special features on the disc because you'll really enjoy them.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll really, really have a good time because you'll see a lot of those faces again, and they'll be talking about one of your favorite subjects, which is Joss.
That's true. All right. Well, I think we need to close things down then for this week. Next week, we'll be talking about some news items and some feedback. So any last words for you, Daniel? Any last words for our listening audience?
No, I'm good. I'm good. Oh, right. My dog has some last words. Mo's decided to chime in. So do you have any last words?
I do. It has to do with a New Year's resolution that I've made, Daniel. Here's the thing. I made a New Year's resolution to take off some pounds, lose some LBs. And that means I can't eat everything that I used to eat. And I think that's okay. You know, I'm not going to be able to eat those great big burgers, you know, because there's just too many calories in those great big burgers. Just all that beef and everything. I'm not going to become a vegetarian, but I'm going to stop eating the same kinds of meat because, but doth not the appetite alter? A man loves the meat of his youth that he cannot endure in his age. Thank you for listening to Welcome to Level 7. We'd love for you to join the conversation. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-77-55, the word level, and then the number 7. That's 1-775-553-8357. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/welcometolevel7. 7 is spelled out. Follow us on Twitter, where we are level7pod. 7 is spelled out. Or email us directly, feedback@welcometolevel7.com. 7 is spelled out. Visit our website, welcometolevel7.com, for news, reviews, and links to our RSS feeds. Our theme music is The Light Fantastic by J.S. Earls, jserls.bandcamp.com. And again, thanks for listening. Is that okay?
Doth spoketh well.
All right. The other one was, if her breath were as terrible as her terminations, There would be no living near her. She would infect to the North Star. But that sounds like you're being mean to somebody, and I don't want to be mean.
It is being mean.
All right.
So, Ben, I've been playing Hurt tonight.
Oh, really? You've been playing through the pain or something, or what? What's going on?
Yeah, my back and tailbone are severely bruised. Right,
okay,
you
said stuff about that on Facebook. What's going on?
So there I was, Ben, sledding with my kids. I mean, who doesn't love sledding? So I was at the sledding hill I haven't been to for a while. I've been there this season at all. So I'm up at the top taking pictures of the kids. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to ride down the hill. I'm going to slide up here for a reason. So as I'm about to get ready to go downhill, I see my son. So I say to myself, okay, I'm going to scoot over a little bit because I don't want to hit him. So I start going down the hill, and I'm like picking up speed, and I'm just booking it. I'm booking it. I'm booking it. I'm booking. And I'm like, this is fun. And then I hit a bump that was solid ice at the bottom of the hill. I lifted up into the air, went flying, and then while I was completely sitting up still, landed on top of a second ice bump. When I landed on my bottom, I actually heard my spine go crunch. So it hurt. It hurt a lot. And I jumped out of the sled, and I started yelling for my sister-in-law, who was with me, who was a nurse. And I could, like, I now know what it means, you know, when somebody talks about getting knocked, the breath knocked out of you, because it hurt so bad that I could barely breathe. So she gets over to me. By the time she gets there, I've laid down on the ground in the snow because, I mean, it just hurts. It's just ringing through my entire torso, this pain. So I'm like talking to her, and this is what I remember. I remember saying to her, off the hill, because I wanted my kids off the hill because my niece had gotten hurt on the same bump earlier. And I was like, I'm done with this because I'm in a lot of pain. And then I remember warm and palm trees, and I'm not lying to you. I'm not lying. Again, remember, I'm outside and it's like 20 degrees. I was suddenly warm, comfortable, and all I can remember is palm trees. And then I woke up, and my sister-in-law was standing over me with a cell phone getting ready to call 911, and the pain was gone. And I mean, I was so sore because I'm bruised, and I'm still bruised right now, but I was just, it was calm, and I was so much better. And I actually drove the kids home at this point, which I shouldn't have done. So I'm in the car, driving home, and I'm talking to my daughter because I'm trying to make sure that I'm, you know, didn't get my bell rung. And so I'm like describing this to her. Did this what happened? Da, 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 da. I remember palm trees. And she looks at me and she goes, Dad, you probably died for like 8 seconds. you're just like Coulson.
Nice. Nice.
So I now know about magical places. Welcome to Level 7, the unofficial Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast. I am one of your two. I'm going to start again. I started laughing on myself.
I started laughing on you too. That's a coincidence. So Don John, played by Sean Maher. I'm not saying any of these names right. Just think Daniel Butcher. If you were in my class in school, you know how much I hated the first day of school with all those names. So, what do you think of Sean playing Don John? Are you there? Did I lose you? I'm not hearing you.
Sometime in the future, this is what's going to happen.
Whoa. What happened?
My back?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
What happened?
I might have been on mute. because I was coughing.
Oh. How long did I go?
It's more of a question of how long was I going.
So you were talking while I was talking?
Well, you would pause and then I'd start talking. And then I'd be like, why are you talking?
Whoops. Where do we want to start over?
We're going to end with you're having horrible time saying the names.
Okay. So that's where we're going to cut in?
Yep.
Special
is
person.
Is it time for your number two?
Well, what's next? That sounds really
the man,
bad.
The myth,
that
the
sounds
legend.
Like something we'd ask our three-year-old son as we're potty
man,
training.
The myth, the legend, Clark Craig.
Is it time for your number two?
Number two.
No, oh, I don't have to go.
I can do a four.
Welcome to Level 7 is a proud member of the Noodle Mix Network. Find more of our award-winning and award-nominated podcasts to make you think, laugh, and succeed at noodle.mx. Learn how to podcast, get productive in your personal and professional life, theorize over TV shows like Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, Under the Dome, and of course, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Laugh with our clean comedy, delve into science fiction and philosophy, learn critical thinking from movie reviews, and more at noodle.mx.